Blog Talk Radio.
On Saturday, February the 8th, day number 39 of 2014. Today we're going to remember the Beatles. You know, everybody's talking about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles this weekend. It was exactly 50 years ago that they came to the United States. In fact, it was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, just like it is today. On Friday, they arrived at JFK Stadium. On Saturday, they were running around taking pictures and holding all kinds of press conferences. And, of course, on Sunday the 9th, just like this year, they had their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. So the exact same weekend as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beatles. A lot being written about it. It's entertaining for people like me to go back and read it. And today we'll be talking about the impact that it all had on the radio business with our good friend Dave Michaels. We usually talk about sports with Dave, but given his knowledge and experience of the radio market here in Dallas, we're going to pick his brain about the Beatles and the radio business. Just a quick plug for my book, Cubanos in Wisconsin. You can get yourself a copy of the book at the Amazon, print, or Kindle, or you can go to our website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, and get a copy directly from us. We'll be happy to dedicate the copy to you. And one of the benefits of reading my book is that you'll get to read how I came to know the Beatles, my encounter with the Beatles. I didn't know a thing about the Beatles. In fact, 1964, I had no idea the Beatles were in New York because that kind of news was not broadcast in Cuba. So it wasn't until September of 64, when we finally made it to the United States, that I was talking to some Cuban kids in Miami, and they showed me a copy of Meet the Beatles, and that was the first time that I ever heard, or the first time that I actually saw a picture of the Beatles, and of course I became a huge fan then. It kind of leads me to a story that I want to share with you before we get to Dave. You know, a few years ago I had an encounter with a fellow from Cuba, a 50-something guy who had grown up in Cuba and had an opportunity to leave the country, and he was telling me something very interesting. You know, we were talking about the censorship, the shortages, the problems that happen in a communist country, and he said, you know, what I really hate about Castro, besides all those other things, is that I never got to experience the Beatles. He says, I never got to live the Beatles experience that you guys got to live in the United States. And I said, man, thank God for freedom. Thank God for freedom. Well, that's one of the benefits of a free country. You get to listen to the Beatles, but we never got to do that in Cuba. We're going to take a break, and we've got Dave Michaels on the other side. Silvio Canto in Dallas, and let me say hello to Dave Michaels. How are you, Dave?
And good morning to you.
Well, we blew it on the Super Bowl, didn't we? Seattle did win, but I don't think either one of us predicted a blowout.
No, but by the way, Lowry's seasoning salt goes really well with crow, and which I've already eaten because. I wasn't even close on that one. Not even. Well, I was like the Denver Broncos. I wasn't even close.
That's right. No, that was a score that I have to tell you. I had no idea. I had no idea that it would end up like that. But you know, even in the first quarter when it was like 14-0 or something, I thought the Broncos still had a chance. But man, when they ran that kickoff back, starting the second half, I said this is not going to work, and it didn't. It didn't work for Denver. But anyway, we're going to switch topics today and talk a little bit about the Beatles and their trip to the United States back in 1964 and look back at the influence that all of that had on the radio business and the radio business here in the United States. So let me just, as I said, I wasn't here in this weekend in 64, but what do you remember of this weekend in 64?
I remember my parents saying, turn that noise off.
Oh, well, your parents did that too, right? I think all the parents,
oh, yeah.
that was typical of all parents.
Well, it was, you know, it was a youthful group with a lot of energy. Of course, let's look at the time frame in 1964 where the United States of America just a few months prior had lost its president to an assassination. The war in Vietnam became very real shortly thereafter. There was already unrest, and unlike today, where, and I say this, where music cycles itself. So here we are in 2014, and already music from 1990s are being recycled. In other words, you're getting people to play the 90s because it's 20 years old. So you cycle out. We never cycled back in the 60s to the 40s music. We never cycled back to the big band era. We kind of skipped over that. We immediately got into rock and roll in the mid to late 50s, and we're talking about people like Bill Haley and the Comets, Chuck Berry, Everly Brothers. Rock and roll was Buddy Holly even was starting to make its influence. And then here comes this mop top group from England in the winter of 64, and they land in New York. Ed Sullivan finds out about them and books them. He's the first American variety act, or variety show, if you will, to book the Beatles. And they play two songs on his show, and the majority of the time you can't hear them because the girls are screaming. And it was an experience that, first seeing them with the long hair, hearing them with the harmonies, and the commercialism, I'll use that word, of what they did. I mean, they wore the same clothes. They wore their hairs were the same style. They bowed in unison. They did a whole package. And it was a very unique situation as a youngster to see this.
Right.
And
interesting.
I was just on the music immediately.
No, go ahead and finish. I was going to throw in something.
I was hooked on their music. I was hooked on their harmonies. I was hooked on their,
right.
I wanted to be a drummer even as an early, early age. And seeing Ringo Starr doing what he did, to me, was phenomenal.
Right. You know, I was just going to make a couple of quick points about those early Beatles. In fact, there was an album called The Early Beatles. I remember that. It was released in Capitol Records, on Capitol Records. But a couple of things about that. First, there were three nights in a row. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Three nights in a row. A lot of people may not know that. February 9th, then the 16th, they went down to Miami, or the 23rd. One of those three nights was in Miami where they did the show from Miami. So he had them on three consecutive nights, which is pretty incredible considering how difficult that show was to get even 2 minutes on that show. But obviously Ed Sullivan realized he had an audience. The other thing that always struck me about the Beatles, the more I got to know them, is that when you go back and you look at their first two or three albums, what we in the United States knew as Meet the Beatles, the Beatles' second album, and the early Beatles, those first three albums that were a combination of their two British LPs. What was interesting to me was the influence, as you were saying, of 50s American music, you know, whether it was Buddy Holly, whether it was Chuck Berry, Carl Perkins, Fats Domino, you know, Long Tall Sally. There was a lot of that influence on the Beatles back then. I mean, they were the music that, you know, in the early 60s, Dave, you remember, you know, you may recall in the early 60s, a lot of Americans were listening to Bobby Vinton, Bobby V, that kind of stuff. But the British young people were actually listening to Chuck Berry and all of that. So I thought that was interesting. They paid tribute to that music by recording so much of it, Dave.
Well, that and now remember the Beatles in 64, in 65, they got a rival that came out of Britain, which was the Rolling Stones. And so at one point, you look at the Beatles and you say, those are the good guys, and you look at the Rolling Stones and those are the bad guys. And not bad in a way that they were mean. It was just like they were harder edge. The Rolling Stones was just a little bit harder edge than the Beatles were. The Beatles were nice and clean and, you know, had nice harmonies. And then you got, you know, Mick Jagger coming out and doing the gyrations and what have you. And, you know, so, you know, there were the Rolling Stone fans and there were the Beatle fans. And it influenced a lot of things in those days. You were talking about radio and how it influenced radio in the early 60s and in top 40, and how that became and how that involved in stations and what have you. I'm certain at the time you were living – You said that by the fall of 64, you were living in where, Wisconsin at the time?
Yeah, Wisconsin, yeah.
Okay. Wisconsin.
The station that we would get there, just to give you a little information about that. In 1964, the station that I would listen to get the Beatles or to get pop music were WCFL and WLS out of Chicago. They had very strong signals that would come in very clearly. There were some local stations, but at nights they lose their power. So when I was a kid, at night after school doing our homework, we had a little transistor radios. We were listening to WLS. That was the station that I was listening to.
So that you were just about to answer my point then, because in Wisconsin, I don't think the Beatle influence got into the local radio stations, which, as the big city station, WLS out of Chicago, was a very major influence. Just like down here in Dallas-Fort Worth. Now, remember back in the 60s, Dallas-Fort Worth wasn't even considered – they didn't combine the two cities until the 70s. In Dallas-Fort Worth, the name itself was not brought together as a combined name or combined metroplex until the 70s. So Dallas and Fort Worth were as separate as Chicago and St. Louis, okay? Even though they're pretty close in proximity, they were very far apart. So it was Dallas and Fort Worth. So Dallas radio and Fort Worth radio were totally, totally separate entities. And it was an interesting format change because Fort Worth, well, that was where the West began, so that's where your country music really was a staunch leader. And WBAP 820 in Dallas, I'm sorry, in Fort Worth. And then you had KBOX also in Fort Worth. And they were very strong in their influence of country. In Dallas, a little more progressive. A guy named Gordon McLinden at 1190 KLIF started to create that top 40 sound, and bringing that top 40 sound brought in top music. Top music meant you had to play the Beatles. I mean, let's face it, in the first couple of years of the Beatles invasion in America, they were on the top 100. They filled it up. It was their music. That's what you were
listening to. You're exactly right. In fact, I was doing a little research for an article that I'm publishing at the American Thinker from February the 1st, like right at this week in 64, until May 9th, during all those 3 months, they had the number one song in the country, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, and Can't Buy Me Love. And then they had three others that year at the number one position. But when you look at the LPs, Dave, it's even more incredible. I was researching this, and the LPs, Meet the Beatles was number one for like 15 weeks, followed by the Beatles' second album, another 8 weeks. And then the album A Hard Day's Night was number one for like 15 weeks. So in 1952, the number one album in the United States was a Beatles album like 34 out of the 52 weeks. You talk about a cash register. The Beatles, it was just unbelievable.
And this is back in the days when they were with Capitol. They were with Capitol Records in those days. They didn't open up Apple until much, much later.
Yeah, until Hey Jude, yeah.
Well, I was thinking more of Abbey Road.
That's right, you're right.
But nonetheless, I mean, and in the history of the Beatles, okay, here's your trivia for the who's the original drummer?
Pete Best.
Ringo Starr.
Yeah, Pete Best.
Pete Best was the original drummer. Who was the fifth Beatle?
Stu McCliffe.
Huh?
Stu McCliffe or Stu? I know his first name was Stu, S-T-U.
Stuart was his first name. Stuart Sutcliffe was his name.
That's right, Sutcliffe.
And,
he was
John Lennon's best friend. And he really didn't play any musical instrument. I mean, they handed him a standard guitar and just told him to fake it. But while they were in Hamburg, this is long before they came to the United States, before they were discovered here in the United States, they were in Hamburg. They were playing in some underground music venues. And after one show, they were out back in the alley smoking cigarettes or what have you. And they got mugged, and Stuart got hit in the head with a brick. And it was Stuart's German girlfriend who created the look of the Beatles. She cut their hairs, and she's the one that created this mop-top look. But Stuart unfortunately passed away because of the blow to the head from the brick, and they finished out that tour in Hamburg, four very angry young men, if you will, because they took Stuart's death very, very hard. And when they came back to the UK and were playing at the Cavern, that's when they got discovered, and that's how they got brought over to the United States. And there's your history about the Beatles, and nobody really cares.
No, that's a great story. That's a great story. I'm familiar with a lot of it because when I got to know the Beatles, I just didn't like their music. I really got to know their story. What I thought was interesting too is how Ed Sullivan. The story goes that Ed Sullivan is either I've heard two stories. One that he was at the airport. The other one is that he was in a taxi. So whichever one is true. But the bottom line is that he was waiting in a taxi or at the airport, and he noticed all these girls. Either the Beatles were arriving in a plane or the Beatles were playing somewhere, and he noticed all these girls, and he said, "What's going on? What is this commotion?" And they said to him, "Well, the Beatles." He said, "Who are the Beatles?" And so they explained it to him, and he said, "Well, the line from Ed Sullivan goes like this: Well, if the British girls do that, I'm pretty sure the American girls will do the same thing." And that was sometime in the fall, November of 63, before he brought him here. So, I'm going to say they had some good luck in being at the right place at the right time, but they certainly paid their dues. I mean, nothing came easy for the Beatles because a lot of groups would have probably just broken up after that experience in Hamburg. That was not an easy way to make a living, playing in those bars and basically just getting enough money to eat. And the four of them slept in a room upstairs. So that was not an easy life for the Beatles.
No,
it amazes me that they stayed together. I guess that was the point.
Well, their lives changed when the guy named Brian Epstein took them and became their manager. Brian Epstein was a record store manager, if you will, and, got in with the guys. He talked to them, and he said, what you need is somebody that can actually manage who you are and what you are and your style. And this is all of Brian Epstein's master plan. Unfortunately, Brian Epstein committed suicide and died. But it was between him and George Martin, the producer, and the engineer that created all that sound, if you will. Those are the two big influences with the Beatles. The Beatles were great songwriters. Lennon McCartney did a great job writing music. They did a phenomenal job writing music. In fact, the majority of their library is worth billions and billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is the guys that actually created that image, created that sound, was a guy named Epstein and a guy named Martin.
That's right. George Martin was a producer, and he really took their songs and arranged them the sound that we came to know. Now, let me get into the radio business for a second, because here we are. The Beatles arrive in 64, and all of a sudden, it was very profitable to play their music because they would create ratings. And here in Dallas, tell us about how the radio stations reacted to the Beatles here. And I ask you that question because of the influence of country in this area. I mean, this is a big country area. How were the Beatles received here in the radio?
Well, in the very, very beginning, in after the Ed Sullivan exposure, radio stations kind of said, wait a minute, this is a group that's really sweeping the sound of what this country needs. And again, going back to the fact that this country was going through a lot of turmoil, the Beatles come in a time where the United States needed kind of a boost in the arm, and okay, so it came from England, who cares? But it was something that they really needed, and a lot of radio stations kind of jumped on that bandwagon. Here locally, we go back to the mighty 1190 KLIF with a guy named Gordon McLendon, who's the owner and the station director, the general manager. He created this top 40 sound. Top 40, a lot of people ask, well, what is a top 40 sound? Top 40 sound was DJs talking up a song until what we call hitting the post, or when the lyrics begin. That little trick where you hear the intro music and then you hear a DJ talking it up, and then boom, there's the lyrics. And that's how Top 40 really got started. Rapid fire discussion, backselling the song. So as the song is fading out, the DJ would come back on and say, well, you were just listening to so-and-so, and then he'd start up the next song and he would talk it up right to the post. And it was called bridging the music. And it was McLennan that started that. Beatles, unfortunately or fortunately, depending how you look at it, they had a lot of songs that started very cold. They didn't have a lot of intro music on some of theirs.
Right.
Sometimes you hear the countdown. You hear I saw her standing there with the countdown on 1, 2, 3, 4, same with She Loves You. They would start that off with a count. Sometimes they just start. You know, there was not much music that they had. Now, when Rubber Souls came out, when the album Rubber Soul came out, and songs like Michelle and Norwegian Wood and things such as that, that's when you got a little bit more creative. But
right, and I'm thinking of that song, Can't Buy Me Love. That starts singing right away, Oh My Loving, you're right.
Exactly.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
It's tough to introduce those songs.
So does, I think, Please Please and
right.
Love Me Do, I think, starts a very short intro, very, very short.
I think the one the DJs must have loved in of that first round of songs, the one the DJs must have really loved must have been This Boy, because there you had a good 10 to 15 second intro they could set up the song, you know?
Yeah, they would, but This Boy was a ballad, and Top 40 would not play ballads. They would avoid playing a ballad unless it was after a certain hour. You didn't hear ballads on a Top 40 station until like after 7 or 8 o'clock at night. Everything was upbeat. Everything was upbeat, high energy. DJs did not sit down. They had a stand-up board. If you worked for McLendon, you definitely had a stand-up board. He didn't believe in anybody sitting down. You had more energy on your feet. And that carried over to Ron Chapman when he started KVIL back in the late 60s. He left KLIF. He was part of the Charlie and Harrigan team. He was Harrigan. And he left that to go to make KVIL. And he took a lot of what McLendon taught him, and he brought it to his station. And he was very, very successful, as we all know, the story behind KVIL, AM and FM here in Dallas-Fort Worth.
That's right. Now, when I was in Wisconsin, there was one DJ in Milwaukee, Bob Berry, who was with WOKY. He may have also been with I can't think of the words, the letters right now, but WTMJ, which was the other big station there. But Bob Berry with WOKY, he was the morning guy. He became very associated with the Beatles. When the Beatles came to Milwaukee, he would introduce him, and he became very associated with the Beatles, just like I guess Murray the K in New York and Cousin Bruzy and a lot of DJs. Who was the equivalent here in Dallas of the one DJ who became so associated with the Beatles?
Well, one guy came to Dallas after being in Pennsylvania. That was Chuck Brinkman. He introduced him up in Pennsylvania, here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It might have been in 64. It might as well have been Ron Chapman and Charlie and Harrigan. Because KLIF was the station that was playing the Beatles. And the thing about the Beatles, when they came to Dallas and they played at Memorial Auditorium, which still exists, by the way. Memorial Auditorium is still part of the Dallas Convention Center in downtown. It's over there by City Hall in Dallas. But they stayed at a hotel in Dallas off of I-35 Simmons Freeway in Continental. And the hotel, by the way, the building existed, but it stopped being a hotel back in the 80s, and it was converted into a jail. It was called the Decker Unit. It was named after Sheriff Decker, Bill Decker. And they left the facade alone. So the drive-through portico that you could drive and drop off your passengers or your guests or whatever still existed. And that's where the Beatles stayed. It was called the Columbia.
And how many concerts did they do here in Dallas? Was that the only time, I guess, they came?
They only came to Dallas once.
Yeah, so 64 and
8. I think they played two shows.
Two shows.
I think they played a weekend. Yeah, I think they played a weekend set, and that was it.
So that must have been when they were touring America that summer into September, because when you think of, you know, they came to New York and they went to Washington, and then they had a big tour, I guess, of America in 64. That must have been when they stopped here. Do you know anybody over the years? Have you met anybody who was at that concert?
My sister had some friends that went to the concert, and there was some tragedy to that concert, because, as you say, the girls go nuts, the girls go wild, and what have you. But there was a tragedy that involved a young girl here in Dallas that got her face pressed against some glass, and the glass broke, and it made front page news in both the Dallas Morning News and the Dallas Times Herald. So there was a little bit of tragedy to that. But my sister had friends from school that went to go see the Beatles.
And what did they say? They had fun.
That, well, obviously, yes, they had fun. They were also the cool. They were the cool kids in school for a few weeks.
That's right. That's right. Maybe
because you got to go. Because you got to go see the Beatles. They were cool.
Right. They could show their tickets. You know, their ticket stubs. We got We got to see the Beatles. Now, another thing too that I think the Beatles influenced, and I don't know how much of this was a coincidence or how much of it was something their music influenced. Maybe a little bit of both, but. By the late 60s, and I remember this again going back to Wisconsin, we had a radio station in Milwaukee. I think it was WRIT. I think those were the initials. They had the FM, the AM signal that was very much of a top 40 station. And then they also had an FM signal that they started simulcasting. And I'll never forget in my dad's stereo in the living room, we used to listen to music, of course, in little radios, but all of a sudden here you have music in the big stereo, and I remember listening to MacArthur Park, that song by Richard Harris, on FM, in stereo, and I just said, my goodness, this is different than anything I've ever heard before. And then, of course, I remember listening to A Day in the Life by the Beatles, also on that frequency, and it was, like, totally different. I think it changed me. All of a sudden, I became a believer in the FM sound, Dave.
Well, a couple of things. One, it didn't sound tinny. It sounded very clear because of the separation of signal that you could have on the left and the right. But, you know, the AM signal had a very tinny, kind of almost a telephone-ish sounding, so it had that filter sound, where FM was extremely clean. It was probably the cleanest sound in those days that we were ever accustomed to. And whether you were in the old tube style of format or if you were in the transistor area, of stereo, where you had, you know, smaller units, what have you, but it still, FM made it much cleaner to hear clean music, and so a lot of FM stations started converting from what we consider back in those days long hair music. In those days was listening to symphony, you know, like classical music, you know, Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, mm-hmm. and then they started switching over to listening to pop and rock and things such as that. And here in Dallas, we had just a handful of FM stations. And they started converting a lot to music. My first solid remembrance of an FM station was 102.1, which their call letters back in those days when they first started was KFWD. And they later changed their call letters to KTXQ and known as Q102 for a lot of years. And they were classic rock, and their format was built upon rock and roll. And you were talking about your influence in the early 60s. Of listening to that big stereo sound. And then when you think about that and continue the evolution of sound to the 80s when CDs first came out, not the album, not the vinyl album, but now CDs, and how much cleaner and how much crisper that sound became.
Oh, I know. I know.
If you grew up on vinyl.
Incredible.
Yeah. And if you played a vinyl song, if you played a vinyl too much, if your needle, you know, was sharp, then the next thing you hear after about 50 or 60 plays was, you know, that was the
that's
sound
right.
you were getting.
That's right. No, that's right. That's why you had to keep the, you know, had to go to Radio Shack often and get yourself a new needle. But you're right. I mean, you're exactly right. The evolution, you know, my musical evolution, you start with a 45. Then you had some stereo 45s, I recall. And then you had, of course, the LP. And then the cassette, which was a little bit better, but not really that much better than a good LP. At least for me, I couldn't tell the difference. And then
of
course,
A-track in there somewhere.
Well, the A-track, the A-track had a pretty good sound too. And then we had a reel-to-reel recorder too, where I actually bought a couple of, you know, albums on reel-to-reel. But it was just cumbersome. I mean, you couldn't take it anywhere. It was just kind of a great sound. No, exactly. It was a great sound. I mean, it sounded great, but it just didn't. It was just not easy to move around. But then, the CD. When the CD came in the 80s, it was like, wait a minute, let's throw everything away and get CDs now. I mean, I just remember Sgt. Pepper's when that came out as a CD. It was like, wow, I didn't hear that sound before, Dave.
Right. No, it was a much cleaner sound when they remastered all of the Beatle music and put it on CD. It changed exactly how that music was to be played. Now you're hearing the music as it was actually performed, either in a studio or on a stage, on a CD. That's the sound you are going to get now.
Right.
So I think that the concert if you hear Get Back on a CD from when they performed on top of the Apple Records building,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was their last public concert, and you hear Get Back and you hear Billy Preston's organ, and you hear things on that CD you don't hear on the album.
Right. You're right. You're right. Now, the one thing that I do remember about the Beatles was that the Beatles would actually release Capitol Records. I don't think they did this in England, but Capitol Records would actually release what they call a high-fidelity copy and a stereo copy, because I know some of my we have an original copy of Meet the Beatles that was actually high-fidelity, and then I bought it in stereo later. But so Meet the Beatles, I think
it was
what, either... Yeah, but yeah, it was called High Fidelity, I guess. But did they actually record it twice, or did they just do it once?
They remastered it. No, it was remastered.
Into stereo.
Everything they did was in stereo. Stereo, the concept of stereo had been around since the 50s. You know, separation of channel had been around for a while. They just didn't know how to produce it so you could hear it in a consumer type of situation. You could hear it in a studio. But you couldn't hear it in a consumer playback unit. I mean, you had our huge consoles with TVs in it were mono. You know, it wasn't. The stereo really didn't make a splash until the mid to late 60s.
Mm.
And then,
yeah, I just remember
hardcore in the 70s.
Right, exactly. In the 70s with a lot more of the album rock, but. What I remember, and I'll never forget, it just got frozen in my mind in the late 60s, where we would go there was a place, it wasn't Target, but it was kind of like a Target Walmart store back then in the late 60s in Wisconsin. We go to this place, and you walk in, and they had the High Fidelity album was $2.94, and the stereo album was $3.94. I'll never forget that. And so it was like you had to make this choice, this tough decision, you know, do I have an extra dollar to get the stereo copy, or do I want to get a single because the singles would sell for like 49 cents? So you had to make those decisions when you had $3 in your hand, you know. Do I get a High Fidelity and a single, or do I go all out and get myself a stereo copy? Those were the things, the decisions that I had to make as a kid buying Beatles albums, Dave.
Well, in here locally in the Dallas area, and you have a lot of old Dallas sites listening in right now, I'm going to really rattle their memory button a bit. We had a store, you were talking about a store similar to Walmart, similar to Target. There was a store here in Dallas called FedMart, F-E-D-M-A-R-T. And FedMart, it was actually in North Dallas, around Forest Lane, Marsh Lane area. And this is back in the days when we actually had a blue law. So on Sundays, you'd go in there and there would be tarps over things you couldn't buy.
Right.
Can buy clothing, can buy hardware, can buy, you know, so we had the blue law. But that's where we bought our albums from. You know, there was a music store directly across the road in the other side of the shopping center, Melody House. And we could go in there and buy records and whatever. But if you're with your parents and doing your weekly shopping, your grocery shopping, there was the records. And, you know, the plea bargaining and the begging that ensued with having records in a store where you're buying food and your parents could care less about who these mop top Beatles are. And you know, you're not buying that. No, 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 no. I got no way too many times. I was told no way too many times.
That's right. That's right. No,
I remember my sister and I, my sister's older than I am. I'm certain she's really glad that I said that on the radio. But
that's right. That's right. Yeah. She's not going to send you a birthday card now.
No, I'm not going to get an attaboy for that one. But because she's a little older than I am, you know, we chipped in and we bought Rubber Souls together. That was an album that we bought together. And we had a little record player in my sister's room. We played the daylights out of that. Of course, my sister's name is Michelle.
Oh, that helped.
Michelle was all about her. Yeah, she thought Michelle was written about her.
Yeah, that helped. Yeah, no, that is a... That is a great song too, and that's a great. And I do remember getting that one in stereo. That one I did get in stereo, Rubber Soul, and that is that. But that also, it's another interesting trivia about the Beatles, or not trivia, but interesting fact about the Beatles. The Rubber Soul LP in England was different than the one here. Different cuts. And I remember we had this kid in high school or in school from England, who was, I don't know if he was here, exactly why he was here, I don't know, but he spent a semester in our school with us, and we were talking about the Beatles. He was a big Beatles fan too, and he said, I really like Rubber Soul, and I said, well, I do too, and what's your favorite song? And he says, Drive My Car, and I said, wait a minute, that's on Yesterday and Today, that's not on Rubber Soul. And he said, what do you mean, Yesterday and Today? What album is that? So I showed him my copy of Yesterday and Today, which is the album in the United States between Rubber Soul and Revolver. And he said, I had never seen that one before. Well, I had never heard that Drive My Car was on Rubber Soul, and also Revolver, too. There were some cuts like that that were different. And it all ended with Sgt. Pepper's. After Sgt. Pepper's, everything was the same. But that's another little bit of trivia question. This friend of mine from England, too, he showed me a really interesting record that I had never seen before. The Magical Mystery Tour album in the United States was released as an LP, but in England it was released as what they call an extended 45. So you basically had all the songs that we have on side one of the Magical Mystery Tour album were released in England as what they call a double single. You know, they had all those six songs were actually released in 2 45s. It was just interesting how it was done there, different than here, you know?
Exactly. And some of the other things about what made Rubber Soul so unique is it was the first time that we were introduced to the sound of the sitar on that album with Norwegian Wood. And then we started getting into George Harrison's experimentation, and it carried over to Magical Mystery Tour. It carried over to Sgt. Pepper. And even into Abbey Road and Let It Be, where that sitar, that East Indian style of music, was actually now being more and more of the influence for the Beatles sound. And by the time the Beatles broke up in 1970, there was a lot of, we know about the bitterness that was going on within the Beatles. And not so much of the creativity, because I still think Lennon and McCartney could have written forever and ever and ever if they really put their mind to it. I think it was more of the fabric of that group was being taken apart by the greed, the money.
Right.
And it happens.
Well, without getting too much into the weeds, you had the business of Apple that became, when they founded Apple, that became very controversial because Apple was actually losing money for a long time. And because they were doing all kinds of crazy, and the Beatles were not losing money, but all of the other stuff they were doing, and that created some managerial conflicts. But when you said the sitar, if we have a Rolling Stones fan listening, I'm sure he would challenge you and say that Painted Black was actually the, and in fact, Painted Black was the first number one song that actually used a sitar. Of course, Norwegian Wood was never released as a single, otherwise it would have been the number one song, but just a little trivia there for, taking care of our Rolling Stones fans, I guess. That's what I'm saying. But Painted Black was number one, and Norwegian Wood, incredibly, nothing from Rubber Soul was released as a single in the United States. I never figured that out.
I haven't either, and it's whatever they decided to do, it's, what's the old adage? It is what it is.
No, I know. You can't. I mean, it's just you look back at it now and you think of all the number one songs they had, how many more they could have had because a couple of their albums, they just didn't release that many singles. I mean, All My Loving was never released as a single in the United States. I mean, that's just incredible. One of the most popular songs.
And interestingly enough, and we can talk about this forever too, you know, Hey Jude was introduced on American television. And do you remember the TV show that it was introduced by?
The Smothers Brothers show, right? Yeah, that was it.
I don't know if
it was introduced in it, but that's when they had their big appearance of that song. Yeah, I mean, I remember that single so well because 7 minutes long. You know, you figured, will that ever end? You know.
Well, it with it being a 7-minute song, also it was a great DJ song because that means that when they laid the needle down, they could go run down to the restroom and take a break.
That's right. That's right. But I will tell you one story. As a radio guy, you'll appreciate this story very much. There was a radio station in Milwaukee, I think it was WRIT, that on weekends would have what they call the Battle of the Bands. So they play one song versus another, and the fans were supposed to call in, and the winner would be played. So they were featuring Hey Jude against a bunch of other songs. Hey Jude kept winning, you know, for like a whole afternoon. Hey Jude, they went like 10 in a row. So by the 10th guy, the DJ said, we're not listening to the 7 minutes this time, you know. So he cut it off like about 4 minutes into the, you know, into the into that ending of the song. But I'm sure you would appreciate that as a radio man, that having that record there for 7 minutes, I mean, that was, it was good to go to the bathroom or get a hamburger, but after a while, it had to be pretty tiresome.
Pretty much, and you can imagine that, you know, the ongoing of na-na-na-na-na-na, it just drives you nuts.
Especially when you were playing it every hour.
That's my point, yes.
I mean, if you were listening to it on the radio, you know, you might hear it twice a day. But the poor DJ was listening every hour. I mean, imagine the people who worked at that station, the poor secretary or receptionist, hearing that song every hour. Now, that's why, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I'm sick of that song. Well, I can understand why. But the one song, and we'll wrap it up, but the one song, it was out by the Beatles, but the one song that made me sick, I just couldn't hear it anymore, and it took me about 20 years until I could hear it again, was Rod Stewart's Maggie May. Because that song was played on the radio so much in Milwaukee. I mean, it was like every 5 minutes you were hearing that song. I couldn't hear it anymore. And it took me 20 years.
Song, yeah.
It took me 20 years of therapy of Maggie May before I could listen to it again.
That's about right.
But I think, you know, to wrap it up, Dave, I think you would agree with me that that the Beatles, their influence went just beyond the music. I mean, they changed or had a big influence in the radio business, and obviously stations, you know, played their music and maybe even changed their formats because of the Beatles, Dave.
Pretty much, and, you know, the influence of what the Beatles became and were, and how the youth of that era grew up with that music as their anthems. When you think about today, the baby boomers and what have you that grew up listening to Beatle music, I mean, here we are, we're talking 50 years later, and their music is still has the same staying power today as it did 50 years ago. I mean, when you hear a Beatles song, immediately, you know, people in their cars will just, you know, crank it up because it's much of an influence for us.
Well, it still does. I'll tell you one last story, Dave. It still does for the young people. You know, our number two son, who's now a second-year student at SMU, when he was at A&M a few years ago, he came home one time for Christmas, and I hear from, you know, his room, I hear the Beatles. And I say, hey, wait a minute, why are you playing my stuff? Where did you find all my old LPs or whatever? And he says, no, Dad, this is not yours. This is mine. I love this group. And I said, you love the Beatles? And I said, yeah, they're really cool. So anyway, they had an influence on not just you and I, but they had an influence on my sons. And I'm sure they'll have an influence someday when I have grandsons and grandchildren because it is really good stuff. It's good music. I guess that's the bottom line.
Well, okay, tell a quick story. There was a tribute band. Called the Fab Four. They did impersonations of it, and what they did was they played live, so they sounded just like them. And they had a left-handed playing bass player that was Paul, and the guy that played John looked just like him, and it was really scary. The only one that didn't look like any of the Beatles was the guy that played George Harrison. He looked like something that just – it was kind of some guy out of place. In any case, they were playing for the Cotton Bowl. The Cotton Bowl, AT&T Cotton Bowl Classic, puts together these little parties, and they invite the alumni and boosters and what have you and media to these parties. And this particular party was at the Anatole, and they had brought in this Fab Four group. And I'd taken my stepson at the time. My stepson at the time was maybe 16, maybe 17 years of age, and he was dragging his feet. He really didn't want to go to this thing. He didn't think he was going to enjoy it at all. And not, because he really wasn't a Beatle fan, but then again, he wasn't really introduced to the Beatle music. Even at 17, he had not been really indoctrinated into that music. When they started and when they ended, the grin on his face never left him. He was so, and then he went right out and started buying a bunch of CDs for the Beatles. But he was in love with the Beatles from that, from just a tribute band that was really good. By the way, if you ever get to see tribute bands called Fab Four or Rain, I highly recommend you go to those shows. If you want to relive the magic of what the Beatles brought, those two tribute bands do a great job on it.
Well, Rain was here in town, I think around the holidays, weren't they? Or they had a show in town, because I remember the posters.
They were here in December.
Yeah, that's December. What I remember. Yeah, because I saw the posters. Somebody was advertising that, or I saw it in the newspaper or the posters. But I just think their music is phenomenal. I wonder, though, I don't know if you know the answer to this. Maybe you do, but I wonder how many records a year they continue to sell. I mean, obviously, all their stuff is available, in internet and all of that. But I wonder, I know their album number one, you know, the one that a collection of number one hits,
mm-hmm.
that was a best-selling album. But I wonder, just on a yearly basis, what their annual sales are to a year. Have you ever heard that?
No, but I can almost promise you that neither Paul nor Ringo would have to ever work again the rest of their lives.
Well, that's true. That's true. I think they have a in their little. I think it's like an annuity. Would you agree?
Well, unfortunately, Michael Jackson bought their library.
That's
at
right.
At one point.
That's right.
So I don't know if they get any of that money. I don't know if Paul would ever get any of that back or not.
I just hope they were able to sell it for enough money that they wouldn't have to worry about it. I mean, they would still have the money come in. But you're right, Michael Jackson. Why? And that's kind of crazy. One more quick question. Why would Michael Jackson do that? I guess just an investment, I guess.
Well, yeah, that and some of their music was being used for commercial use. I mean, they were, you know, using some of the Beatles music for commercials. And,
that's right.
You know, you get residuals off that.
Right. Well, every time, Dave, that I think about every time I think back at the Beatles or think of the Beatles, I think the one song that kind of, you know, I think sort of summarizes everything was In My Life, you know, because I think that's a song obviously about, you know, looking back and losing people that meant something to you. And so I think that one song, In My Life, is the one that probably will stay around for a long time, because I think it's a good song for all of us to look back, I guess, in my life. Some of the other songs that I like Paperback Writer a lot. It's always one of my favorites. I like All My Loving a great deal. I like, you know, something like Don't Let Me Down, which is the B-side of Get Back. I really like that, although that didn't get a lot of airplay as much as Get Back. So just a lot of great songs that they did. And you know, you can still go to YouTube these days and watch some of those old videos. Hello, Goodbye was another one that I remember on the Ed Sullivan Show when they put that little film that they were in. So it just brings you a lot of happy memories. And it's kind of fun to look back 50 years later and say, my God, where did the last 50 years go? It's just remarkable how time flies, if nothing else.
That it does.
That it does. Well, Dave, we'll talk sports the next time, but I just thought we would enjoy a little Beatles memory lane. I remember there was a radio station in town. I think it was WBAP. They had a show called 820 Memory Lane. Well, that was a great show for a title for oldies, you know. So we did a little bit of memory lane today, Dave. Thanks for your time.
There you go.
Thanks for all the input. It was a lot of fun.
I appreciate it, and we'll do it again soon.
We'll do it again soon. Dave Michaels, my good friend here in Dallas. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with a closing commentary right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, Saturday, February the 8th. Just a great chat with Dave Michaels about the Beatles and looking back. You know, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have the exact same weekend, you know, in terms of September the 7th being a Friday, September the 8th a Saturday, and September the 9th being a Sunday. That's exactly the way it was in 1964. September the 7th, Friday, is when the Beatles landed in New York, and I'm sure you've seen all the videos of their arrival at John, it is now called John F. Kennedy International Airport. I'm not sure if that was the name back then, but maybe it was. I'm not sure. because President Kennedy had only had been assassinated a couple of months before, so I don't know if they had already changed the name of the airport. But anyway, we call it JFK International Airport today. And they landed there, and you can see that great video of the guys, you know, coming down the steps there from that Pan American flight. And then, of course, on the 8th, they're running around taking pictures. And then on the 9th, on Sunday, they go on the Ed Sullivan Show, where something like 70 million people tune in. And Dave was just sharing his own memories of that night. And when I look back at all of this, of course, I never got to see it because I was in Cuba at the time, had no idea what was happening, had no idea, had no clue of what was happening up here. But we look back at it, and it's fun to look back at it because it was it was one of those moments that made a difference. I think the Beatles were, you know, a lot of other groups have had their moments, but none of them have had the lasting impact, of course, that the Beatles have had. I mean, there's still a great influence today. If you're putting together a rock band, you know, a garage band, or you're, you know, 17, 18 years old and you're playing drums or guitar, you're going to be influenced by the Beatles. You're going to be a fan of the Beatles to some degree. You may not play their music, you may not listen to the music, but you know who the Beatles were, and you have some influence of the Beatles in your sound. So the Beatles have been around for a very long time. And on our show on Sunday, we're going to be talking to Bill Katz. Bill, of course, is the editor of Urgent Agenda, and Bill was, in fact, in New York when the Beatles were there. And he's got his own little memories of what that was like. It must have been just absolutely electric, that show on Sunday night, the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. I've seen the videos. It was electric to watch it. It must have been 10 times more electric sitting there in that, I guess that show, Coliseum or wherever Ed Sullivan did his show from, just to see the energy of the fans and the energy of the Beatles. I think even Ed Sullivan got caught up in it. I mean, he was usually a pretty serious guy, but even he got caught up in the Beatles excitement. Well, anyway, thanks for listening to our show today about the Beatles, looking back at the Beatles 50 years later, their influence in music, their influence in the radio. My thanks to Dave Michaels for joining us. Obviously, Dave knows a lot about the radio business, and that's why we wanted to talk to him. Don't forget our show with Bill Katz on Sunday and our Spanish lesson. We started this last week. We're doing a Spanish lesson on Monday night, so I hope you tune in and spend that time with us. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying have a great day, and we'll talk to you later. Goodbye from Dallas.